When I ask investigators to present cases from their practices, I pretty much leave it up to them whom to select. And sometimes our faculty members surprise me, as was the case with my meeting with Dr. Axel Grothy, who began our conversation by presenting a follow-up of a patient he first presented at a colorectal cancer think tank in the summer of 2008.
The first case is actually interesting because I changed therapy because of the meeting in Miami.
The think tank?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Actually, the patient is in one of your earlier CDs.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those. It's a patient, now early 50s, young woman, very healthy otherwise, was diagnosed with metastatic colon cancer, two ovaries. It was actually initially thought to be ovarian cancer, got resected and found to be colorectal cancer metastasis, peritoneum, and liver. So we treated her, it was apparently non-resectable, I mean, not curative in the sense that, you know, ovary, peritoneum, liver, you're stretching it, multiple liver metastasis. And I started her on 4-FOX-BEV, 8 cycles, stopped oxaliplatin. I mean, that's what I routinely do. You see that the response really goes down over time. I mean, the first scan you do, the response is, actually the majority of the response happens on first scan. At the second scan, after 8 cycles, she more or less had, she had a little bit minor response compared to the prior scan, but you know, you could see it slowed down, CA had normalized, everything was fine. She was doing great on 4-FOX, a little bit of neuropathy, but I said, you know, we'll stop oxaliplatin before neuropathy really hits, and we kept her on 5-FU bevacizumab for 2.5 years. And she was doing fine. We spread the intervals between the 5-FU and bevacizumab administration. She was doing great, and the liver metastasis, which we followed, calcified. So you saw some calcification on the scans. And eventually, I mean, the radiologist said, you know, we really are not sure this is a viable tumor. So this is where I came to the think tank meeting.
Yeah,
and
I
actually presented this
case. Right,
and then
right.
Everyone said, you know, you're going to stop this treatment. I mean, you're going to treat her. I don't know why you're treating her. You're diluting the chemotherapy. And we gave her that time 5-FU every 4 weeks, which is probably not, I mean, it doesn't work that long. So we gave her bevacizumab every 4 weeks. So I said, yeah, they're probably right. Probably I'm just thinking I'm running against the wall here. So I stopped therapy. Next time she came back, we stopped therapy. Said, you know, sometimes it's good to get some external opinion. So we stopped therapy.
Was she the one who was the nurse?
Yep.
Yeah.
She's a nurse.
Hmm.
So we stopped therapy.
How old is she?
50, early 50s now.
Kids?
Yep. Two healthy
right,
kids.
Right, I remember that.
Yeah.
So you sat down with her and said, well, we had this meeting, we talked about it, and I think maybe we ought to stop therapy?
Yes, she had come to me before and had said, kind of early summer 2008, said, you know, I was about to say we should stop, and then Tony Snow died.
Right.
That's the patient. I said,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yep.
And then she continued on, and she had no side effects. Never any side effects on this continuous infusion 5-FU plus bevacizumab, no bolus component. I never could convince her to switch to capecitabine because she had read about it, nurse involved in some of these issues. So she perceived capecitabine from what she read as more toxic than continuous infusion 5-FU, whether it's right or wrong. So she carried on with this treatment until I told her after our meeting, I think when I looked at my very experienced peers and they all said, you know, you should stop therapy because it's probably just nothing there anymore. So we stopped therapy in October and she had been rock solid stable until then. No signs of actual active tumor. Scan 8 weeks later, significant tumor progression.
Wow. Scan of what?
Scan, I mean, it's
liver.
It was liver. Yeah, that's what we followed. I mean, it had been so stable for so long. And
what else? Markers, CA?
Markers went up. CA went up.
How high?
Not remarkable. She never had a very high marker. It went up from very normal levels, 1.2 to about 8, and which for her is significant.
Any other disease?
No disease that we could
pick up. So her liver mets just went boom.
There was some idea about peritoneum. Actually, there was a lymph node in her pelvis which enlarged, so which could be a peritoneal implant low kind of in the cul-de-sac or really a lymph node implant in this area. So there's not just liver, but a little bit more liver.
I must have been a bad feeling.
I felt bad. I told her, you know, this is really very educational for me because we're approaching a new area and now a new field in oncology when we talk about duration of therapy. how long do we keep patients on this treatment that actually works, we feel probably more inclined to change treatment and stop if there are side effects. You know, if this patient had severe side effects, no discussion, we probably have stopped a year or two earlier. But she had no side effects.
Of course, now, she always theoretically could have developed a problem. You never know.
Bowel perforation, arterial vein, long-term.
What did you do? That's what I want to know.
I put her back on FOLFOX Bev. So she had a great response on FOLFOX. So we had to, I told her, you know, because the progression was actually so significant that I did not dare to just use 5-FU bevacizumab again. I wanted to get ahead of the cancer and be a little bit more intense in our approach. She has received 2 cycles now, and her tumor mark has dropped. I haven't done scans yet. She's due for a scan in about 2 weeks. So we'll see. I mean, from all I see from the tumor marker development, you know, that it went down again.
Tumor markers went back to normal?
Back to 3.2. Yeah,
I hope she responds. God, that's terrible.
Yeah, and it's really interesting for me to, because I thought sometimes you run yourself into a case thinking, you know, this is the only way it can happen. This is the only way that should work. And you talk to people and say, you know, you're nuts. You should stop therapy. So that's what I did. And no one can definitively say, you know, this is why she had progressive disease. She could have had progressive disease anyway. But the time to coincidence was so strong that I thought getting her off treatment, scan 8 weeks later, suggested significant progression. So we'll see. I mean, she is not discouraged. She has tolerated the treatment. We, in our discussions, actually back to the initial discussions we had 3.5 years ago, when I told her that my goal of therapy for her would be to keep her around in good quality of life, and that she actually realized at that point, at least, you know, when we talked, there was no cure. So in some way, she had never thought she would ever be completely tumor-free. But then, of course, over time, you get this idea, you know, I don't feel anything. No one sees any cancer anymore, so I might be free of tumor long-term. And somehow, it didn't work.
You know, and it's tricky, too, for us as a CME group to deal with anecdotal information. Sometimes we have people discuss cases on our series where they take extraordinary measures and whatever. It's all anecdotal, and we get emails saying, you know, I don't know what to say, really, because obviously one case doesn't prove anything.
No.
And I think the other thing that's interesting about this issue about continuation of biologics, where we hear, this is a story that goes into every tumor line on almost every biologic, is it's just really hard to separate out the issue of finances.
Oh, I couldn't agree.
We had a meeting a few months ago where we said, you know, if Bev were generic or something, how much more would you use? And it's just a reality of it. But if you do take a step back and you look at patients like this one who is getting Bev and 5-FU, the reality is that most of these people have a pretty good quality of life.
Yeah. There are several issues. Number one, she had no side effects. She worked full time. She was not compromised in her daily activities. I mean, she's a fully functional member of the society, paying her taxes and all these things. She's working as a nurse. I mean, in this whole context of, you know, what is a treatment worth? Cost effectiveness. It is not just drug costs. If we can make her live longer. I mean, it's very different to put a price tag on her life. And you might actually say that someone who's in her 50s, raising kids, you know, whatever, is this life gained time more worth than someone who's 86 years old and who has already raised kids and everything's fine? It's not. It's very difficult to.
I think people look too simply also at the cost of medication. I mean,
yes.
It's not making the medication. It's doing the trials, investing gigantic amounts of money. A lot of times it doesn't even work out.
Yeah.
I don't know what's right, but yeah. It is expensive.
Yeah. But I can tell you, the more I see patients, the more I see preclinical data, the more I observe my treatment behavior, I strongly believe that continuation of some form of therapy, keeping tumors at check, is better than what we've done before, several years ago, treating for a finite number of cycles and then waiting what happened.
I was flashing on, when you were telling about this woman, for some reason I flashed on Steve Jones from mm-hmm. U.S. Oncology. I remember how he used to talk to me before the aromatase inhibitors came in about tamoxifen. And he always said, I don't know, I've got these women around 10, 15 years. They had 5 positive nodes, and I've stopped a couple of them, and then they came back, et cetera. And I guess, again, you know, even trying to do research to answer these questions takes so long and involves so many patients. And it's, you know, you did the Bright Tumor Registry thing, which obviously was really the beginning of a lot of this thinking. That was about a year and a half ago, right?
Yeah,
that was ASCO 2007.
Correct. Uh-huh.
And, you know, honestly, I hear a lot of criticism of that from other tumor types, because obviously Bev is an issue in lung cancer and breast cancer and renal cell, et cetera. And, oh, you know, it's a registry study. It wasn't really a study, et cetera. But on the other hand, it's not like we have evidence against this concept either, do we?
Yeah, no, we don't. And when you look at the magnitude of benefit that is was in this registry, I think this is something that at least has to raise a flag and say, we need to test this prospectively. And I completely agree with you. I mean, the implications of this effect are huge, because Bev and VEGF inhibition probably works in a lot of different tumor types. So we're not talking about, let's say, a niche indication. We're not talking about, let's say, a treatment of GIST, for instance, which is a small little indication. We're talking about breast cancer, lung cancer, colon cancer, potentially other tumors. But if this biologic principle of continuation of biologic therapy is true, then we need to test it, and we probably need to employ it at some point.
Well, it is being tested, right, in the IBET study? How's the accrual going?
You know, the IBET study, the S0600 study, had to be modified to account for the fact that, number one, cetuximab was in all arms. Number two, KRAS came about.
Of course.
And so we're dealing with a phenomenon that a lot of our clinical trials right now have to account for the fact that colorectal cancer is at least two diseases, probably more diseases, but we're now dividing all our patients into KRAS wild-type, KRAS mutant. Our trials have to be modified accordingly. So the trial hasn't actually been reopened after the modification yet. And it's been morphed into a different question. It's been morphed to address the issue, is continuation of bevacizumab better than introduction of cetuximab in second-line therapy in KRAS wild-type tumors?
So what's the actual design?
So you have patients who have progressed on FOLFOX, CAPOX, OPTIMOX, bevacizumab, would be randomized to either two arms. Irinotecan-based therapy plus cetuximab or bevacizumab in KRAS wild-type tumors. So KRAS mutant tumors are kind of an orphan disease right now, and to some extent in terms of drugs we can use, because we know, okay, chemotherapy works, bevacizumab works in KRAS mutant tumors, but we're utilizing KRAS mutant tumors as a platform for drug development.
So 2-3 years from now, are you going to tell me, hey, the accrual is complete and, you know, we're going to get some answers soon, or we had to close the study because we couldn't get anybody on it?
I think the question whether bevacizumab should be continued beyond progression will be answered by a European trial, because they had a very pragmatic approach to this, looking at all therapy with Bev first line. Then second line, all therapy you want. You cross from FOLFOX to FOLFIRI, from FOLFIRI to FOLFOX, with or without bevacizumab. And that's a company-sponsored, Roche-sponsored European trial, initially initiated by the German AIO, now expanded throughout Europe. They have a decent sample size of about 1,000 patients, so we'll have this question answered.
The other thing is, this thing about continuation of biologics when progression has been something that there's been discussion about for years and years. And of course, every time that comes up, the first thing people will talk about was Herceptin, you know, trastuzumab in breast cancer. Dennis Slamon, well, you just keep it going and you change the chemo, and, you know, women would just continue on it as they switch through different chemotherapies.
Yeah.
Everybody thought it was just sort of hocus pocus. And then last, you know, the June 2008 meeting, the German group, Ben Mankiewicz, they somehow pull off the study that we could never get done. And either capecitabine alone or continue trastuzumab and add CAPE. And lo and behold, continuing the trastuzumab clearly looked better.
They look better. And they even have another piece of information from a registry, similar to the BRIGHT registry. Now, when we call it bevacizumab beyond progression, BBP, it's TBP, you know. And it's we get more and more solid data on that.
Well, we're really seeing that now in HER2 positive breast cancer, that, you know, with lapatinib in there and other anti-HER2 agents, this whole strategy. I think that's the one example I can think of right now in oncology where that's really playing out. All right, so let's go into your 16-year-old.
Now, that's an interesting case. Yeah, she was 16 years old when she developed shortness of breath. She was diagnosed with lung metastasis and a tumor in her left supraclavicular region, which was thought to be a lymphoma, you know, Hodgkin's lymphoma. That's what you think about in a 16-year-old. They biopsied it was an adenocarcinoma. She came to Mayo Clinic, And it was interesting because the adenocarcinoma suggested a colorectal primary, which in a 16-year-old, no one really wanted to believe. And before anything was done, she actually came to Mayo Clinic, no colonoscopy. We did the colonoscopy, and she had a highly stenotic tumor in her rectum.
No symptoms?
You know, it's an interesting point because the tumor was really very narrow, but she could still pass her bowel movements. And, you know, a 16-year-old, it's very difficult for her probably to verbalize.
I can't even conceptualize it.
Yeah.
I mean, walking into the room, I can't even imagine it.
So when I saw her for the first time, she had lymphadenopathy all through her midline, from her rectum up her midline body to her left supraclavicular region, had lung metastasis, confluent lung metastasis, was on oxygen, and didn't have liver metastasis, interestingly, and was really, really sick. So what do you do with a young girl like that? I mean, and she would actually qualify for a pediatric oncologist, but who as a pediatric oncologist knows colorectal cancer?
So you saw her yourself?
So I saw her myself, and parents, of course, were all in the room. They've always been involved and actually very supportive. It was a very supportive family, only daughter. Just in her, you know, high school age, think about very different things than having cancer, and having colon cancer, just starting to date a little bit. It's, you know, more came with her little bear, you know, teddy Jeez. Bear to the first appointment. It's unusual for me because you normally, as an adult oncologist, I don't see these patients. You have some patients at the age of 17, 18, with FAP and HMPCC that are predisposed for these cancers. But we actually checked her genetic makeup, and there's nothing, no HMPCC, no FAP, nothing that we could ever identify as a genetic predisposition, no family history.
Could they get to the rest of the bowel through that lesion?
They did. They did initially. So it was wide enough to get through there initially, at least. And then, you know, we have discussions about how do you talk to a patient like that on prognosis? It's very difficult.
Was she asking you questions?
She was not asking questions. She was actually completely overwhelmed. She was in oxygen. She was short of breath. She was really in distress when I saw her. And her parents asked most of the questions. And we actually, at the same day, started her on FOLFOX bevacizumab.
Wow.
Because she was so sick, in distress, that I thought, we don't have a lot of room to play here. And so we started her on FOLFOX bev. And she had a little bit of kind of spontaneous bleeding from her rectal cancer. And it increased a little bit on bevacizumab, but never to the extent that there was any severe complication. The next time I saw her 2 weeks later, in all honesty, I saw her back a week later because it was such a fragile situation that I want to make sure that things are better. And she actually was off oxygen by that time. She was off oxygen. She was able to communicate more. She asked more questions, had lost a little bit of the anxiety being in distress and being in this Mayo Clinic medical environment as a 16-year-old. And I saw her again a week later for a second cycle, and she actually drove to Mayo Clinic from quite a distance to make things happen, and her parents drove her, which was about a year and a half ago, for repeat appointments every 2 weeks to get her treatment. And I always try to kind of connect her to some local oncologists because that was a seven-hour drive every other week.
Seven hours each way? Wow.
They were hesitant to let go of the, you know, things are working out. So she had an excellent response. I mean, the CT scans almost completely cleared after 8 cycles of treatment, to the extent that I actually talked to our surgeon about, you know, I mean, she still has her rectal cancer, which was kind of stenotic. So, I mean, are we running into complications?
And did she have symptoms at one?
No, she never complained about symptoms. And interestingly, this is very interesting, because then surgeon took her to, he said, let me take a look at it. So he did a rectoscopy, and he told me that the opening was just about 2 millimeters.
Wow.
So it had actually gotten worse on therapy. Not in terms of tumor progression, but some kind of scarring happened. So he said, you know, we need to do something. So we stopped bevacizumab, continued one more cycle of FOLFOX, and she actually went to have an APR and to have an LAR, low anterior resection, with a transitory ileostomy. So she had a back, which was not nice for her as a 16-year-old, but there was the chance to reverse the back and get her ostomy taken down at some point down the line. So we restarted her treatment after she had her surgery. I have to kind of go back a little bit and say that the pathology report of the primary tumor, which was resected, actually showed a complete response of the primary tumor. There were some lymph nodes which still had viable cells, but it was mainly necrotic tumor. But the actual stenosis was just scarring. She never had radiation therapy in this area, so it was just chemotherapy plus bevacizumab. So then the goal was for her to be ready for the start of her new school year without a bag. So our goal was to see, can we take the ileostomy down, give her a break of chemotherapy, break of bevacizumab, safely without harming her too much? Because she had a great response. So we stopped bevacizumab. Sometime in June, she had a surgery, a little bit delayed for logistic reasons, about 8 weeks later. And the ileostomy was taken down. A scan about 2 weeks later, after the ileostomy was taken down, showed dramatic tumor progression.
Wow.
Dramatic tumor progression. By that time, she had about 10 cycles of FOLFOX.
Any neuropathy?
Yeah, she had significant neuropathy. Actually, she said she would not like to have FOLFOX again. So by that time, she was at home. She wanted to go to school. She had her back taken down. She was getting lower back pain from the lymph nodes that had reemerged. She was getting a little bit short of breath, coughing again because we saw the lung metastasis again. And so I hooked up with the local oncologist, and she was treated with FOLFIRI. We couldn't use bevacizumab right away because she was still too close to the ileostomy takedown.
Plus she had the neuropathy.
Yeah, but bevacizumab, you know, you would not. Initially, I wanted her to get FOLFIRI-BEV.
Oh,
you
know, right.
But she could only get FOLFIRI because she was too close to the surgery, and she had severe side effects. I mean, she was hospitalized, had dehydration,
diarrhea,
kidney failure for some time. And it was actually transferred to our inpatient unit from far away from her local hospital to Mayo Clinic. And it was just kind of rehydrating her, treating. She probably had an infection. She never had C. diff, but it was a complicated case at that point. But we saw that even in this last scan, within 3 weeks, her tumor had further grown. So now we had a patient who apparently had not tolerated irinotecan in the dose with FOLFIRI, at least in the initial dose, was really sick. And so what to do? Fortunately, we had tested the tumor for KRAS mutations. So it was KRAS wild type, which is nice. So what I actually did while she was in the hospital, while she was sick, we started her on cetuximab monotherapy.
And you were holding the Bev because she was still post-op?
You know, she had some abdominal discomfort. There was some significant diarrhea and bowel wall injury. There was actually
right.
a question of, do we ever need to go back in surgically?
Right.
You know, so bevacizumab yeah. didn't appear to be
right.
the best drug. And chemotherapy was more or less, at this point in time, out of the question because, I mean, she had apparently had an infection. She had infectious complications. She had fever. She had not tolerated irinotecan, and she didn't want oxaliplatin. So fortunately, if you have a KRAS wild-type tumor, you have a drug that does not cause myelosuppression, that does not really interfere with any bleeding or wound healing complications. So we gave her cetuximab single agent. And, you know, this is one of the things, if you hit the right target, if cetuximab works, it works fast. So after 2 weeks, when I saw her back for potentially continuation of therapy, she had markedly improved. So I honestly don't know what else we could have done because there was clearly no indication to give irinotecan with her diarrhea. Oxaliplatin, FOLFOX would have been a stretch. Bevacizumab alone, not for various reasons, keeping in mind that it doesn't work by itself. So cetuximab single agent was, in my eyes, an excellent choice for her.
So where is she right now?
Okay, so we continue treatment with now irinotecan and cetuximab, but at a markedly reduced dose of
cetuximab. So you started out just with cetuximab alone, and then as she got better, you brought in the irinotecan.
Brought the irinotecan at 50% dose. And she's tolerating it very well. She had a marked response. We're almost back to where we were. So in terms of, you know,
and that's where she is now?
That's where she is now.
How long has she been on the irinotecan?
Irinotecan now, probably since October, meaning about 3 to 4 months.
What's her quality of life and functional status?
She's at school. She has a boyfriend who she's going to be engaged to very
wow.
soon. So
jeez.
It's still tough for me to see her and realizing that there's probably some disconnect. As much as we talk about goals of therapy, because we've, of course, started to talk about goals of therapy, that we can't get the tumor out of her body, that this is her life-limiting factor, that the goal is to kind of keep the tumor controlled as long as possible. This will eventually not be possible anymore, quality of life issues, etc. But there is some disconnect between what she fully realizes. And I mean, there is no question that a 17-year-old, 16-year-old patient, she's 17 now, is not able to fully comprehend, you know, what's going on, or it's not very likely to comprehend the full implication.
I want to ask you about some of the clinical and biologic implications of this extraordinary case, but also curious about your interaction with her parents.
So first of all, her parents are very supportive. I mean, it's a very positive interaction. We communicate on many levels. I mean, first of all, of course, when I see her, we communicate by email, which I think has helped very much in order to kind of keep communication flow going, because, you know, I'm not that easy to be reached sometimes. And I think this has helped us kind of shifting around some critical situations, particularly when she came back to the Mayo Clinic at some point. So interactions with them, they're very supportive. We are very open about the treatment. You know, they are carrying her daughter on their hands. It's a German expression, probably. And they allow her, it's interesting, the parents have actually allowed her probably more freedom now than they actually did before. When I saw her initially, she was in a very protected environment. I could sense that. She was the only child, very kind of cared for person. Now they allowed her, which they would probably never have done a year ago, to go to Arizona over Christmas and spending Christmas holidays there with her boyfriend.
And she's engaged.
She's engaged, yeah.
I'm just speechless. I don't even know what to say. What about the biology of this tumor? Obviously, this is not a typical situation. It sounds like she's had extraordinary responses to two different biologics.
Correct. She had extraordinary responses whenever we treated her, being mindful about the side effects. I mean, she has the significant neuropathy. She didn't like oxaliplatin at the end of the cumulative neuropathy. She had not had a good experience with normal dose FOLFIRI. Hospitalization, dehydration, infection. Now she's tolerating it fine. She does, probably for her, one of the issues is she has developed alopecia on irinotecan, even at the half dose that we use, 50%. But it's not bothering her too much. But again, she's a 17-year-old now. She's a teenager. She wants to get engaged. She is in high school. I think alopecia might matter for her.
I mean, again, anecdotal medicine, but it kind of sounds like a similar theme to your first case. Yeah. I mean, unless you want to say it was just coincidence when you stopped to do the surgery that, you know, she progressed.
No, I do believe this case here with a significant progression in the treatment-free interval after long stabilization, actually an excellent response, it adds to the story. And I can tell you a lot of my colleagues would agree to that. Continuation of therapy matters. And the key issue that we have to keep in mind is continuation of therapy kind of has to be balanced with quality of life issues. If we had theoretically a treatment, a biologic agent or a low-dose chemotherapy, whatever you call it, which we could give without any significant side effects, and we made a difference by increasing survival and progression-free survival significantly, perhaps by a year, this would be worthwhile.
So I can hear the voices of some of your colleagues who might say, well, this is just one case and it doesn't prove anything and et cetera, et cetera. But again, those are the people who told you to stop therapy on the first patient, right?
Yeah. I mean, not only that, I mean, it's in the end, and being a clinical research, I realize the only evidence-based medicine results we can actually accept is a randomized clinical trial where you exactly test what you see. But on the other hand, not all clinical situations will ever be mirrored by results of a randomized clinical trial.
Yeah, there's other evidence besides phase 3 studies.
Yes.
And useful evidence.
Yeah, and we'll never cover all situations in normal oncologists and clinical practice encounters. And you could go back to say, oh, this was tested in this phase 3 trial with 1,000 patients. So we learn from cases. That's part of the individualization of therapy, because individualization of therapy doesn't only mean we test biomarkers and then know what to treat patients with. I think the most important way to individualize therapy is to look at the patient and see what this patient needs and how this patient and the tumor has reacted on therapy.
So I just jotted down here on a piece of paper, this is intergalactic tumor board, because this is just, I don't even know what to say about these cases, but let's do your third one.
Okay. It's a little bit more straightforward. Okay. First of all, it's an 80-year-old, actually retired ophthalmologist, who presented with liver metastasis resectable liver metastasis in a synchronous situation, meaning liver metastasis diagnosed at the same time as the primary tumor was diagnosed.
Where was the primary tumor?
The primary tumor was in his cecum.
And how exactly did he present?
He presented with anemia and was worked up and eventually had a colonoscopy. He's one of those physicians who did not have a screening colonoscopy at the age of 50 every 10 years.
So what was his lifestyle like at the time that he was diagnosed?
He had retired, lived with his wife, and had actually links to Mayo Clinic through his son, who was in a fellowship now at Mayo Clinic, or had gone through fellowship at Mayo Clinic, who's now practicing himself. So there is some connection to our institution. Lived a normal life as a retired ophthalmologist, no significant comorbidities. Hypertension was on statin, but nothing extraordinary in terms of, you know, comorbidities. He was a healthy 80-year-old guy.
And this was occult bleeding?
Occult bleeding,
just
yes.
With anemia?
With anemia, yeah.
And what was going on in his liver? Where were the tumors?
The tumor, he had three liver metastases in his right slash one metastasis kind of straddling between left and right. So in the end, clinically, clearly resectable. And the issue was, you know, how to manage this case. And we talked with him about preoperative, postoperative chemotherapy, et cetera, et cetera.
Of course, that's the big controversy right now when you have somebody who presents with a resectable liver met or mets, although this is a little trickier because he's got a primary in place.
So what he eventually opted for was to have preoperative chemotherapy. Just in a synchronous environment, a synchronous tumor situation, you gain biologic information by testing the chemosensitivity of these cancers. And, you know, in an 80-year-old patient, even if you don't have any comorbidities, you're still kind of, I think you need to be really sure that this tumor responds to therapy, because the idea is, you know, to later subject him to postoperative treatment. And I would like this tumor to respond before I see that I subject these patients to treatment.
As a physician, was he jumping in there, getting on the web and trying to understand all this stuff, or just sort of sitting back and saying, what do I do?
Sitting back. I mean, he acknowledged me in ophthalmology and oncology, and he was long retired. I mean, it's probably different if someone is in his 66, just recently retired. He's long retired, and he was a very pleasant patient who was very accepting, asking the right questions. His wife was always on board. Sometimes his son chimed in, you know, from outside. He was not oncologist, an internist. But overall, a very pleasant physician-physician interaction, actually, in this case.
And I guess one of the questions I'm sure he must have asked you, and I know you talked to him about, is, do I maybe have a curable situation?
Yes. And now we addressed that, and I said, you know, in principle, yes, if we can render him free of disease, and he only had three metastases, resectable, actually, to begin with, one lobe involved, three metastases, not involving any critical structures. So I talked to him that he does have a potential chance to be, let's say, disease-free long-term, whatever that means.
And that something else, basically.
Yeah. And
think about it.
You have to think about it. You know, it's in an 80-year-old patient, you also have to, and I don't like this word, the competing reasons for dying. I mean, that's one of the assessments that we make when we talk about adjuvant therapy. You know, what's the competing risk for death in a patient who's 80 years old, but he's healthy, and why wouldn't I give him the benefit of doubt and treat him?
Yeah, there's numbers, because we played with the adjuvant online model so much. We worked a lot with Peter Ravdin, and I think, you know, that model has really sensitized people to the actual numbers in terms of how likely competing morbidity and mortality is. And it seems like it's more when a patient gets to be 85 or 90 that you really see a big bump up of that. 80, still good.
And again, someone who's in good performance.
Right, yeah, of course. No comorbidities, absolutely. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a little bit of cardiovascular hypertension and hypercholesterolemia. So he actually, we didn't have to shrink the tumors to make it resectable. So for him in this age group, whatever, I suggested using FOLFOX for three cycles, seeing how it responds, and then do the resection and see what happens.
FOLFOX alone or with Bev?
FOLFOX alone, because, you know, it's a short course, and you would have to stop it one or two cycles before you take patients to surgery. So in reality, he would only have gotten one cycle of bevacizumab, FOLFOX, and then the next two cycles would probably be without.
So you gave him how many doses of FOLFOX?
Three cycles, three doses
of
FOLFOX.
Any effect on the tumor?
Yeah, the tumor shrunk. Actually, one area was almost non-visible anymore on a subsequent CT scan.
You know, you've been part of this infamous MetResect project that we've been working on now for about a year, and we're about to launch pretty soon. It really really specifically focusing on these kinds of patients. We have this interdisciplinary group with the oncologists, surgeons, and radiologists. And, you know, I guess this situation really kind of fits into that. And one of the issues, I guess, that we talked about, and we all got together in Miami, too, to discuss this, Steve Curley and Mike Chody, John Primrose. And one of the things they were bringing up was the question of, like, in a patient like this who starts out resectable, is the impact of chemo on the liver.
Yeah.
They brought up the question of the obese or diabetic patient in particular. Mm-hmm. Was that a concern with this man?
Yeah. So the concerns are really obese patients and duration of therapy.
Right.
So you talk about changes to the liver architecture by our treatment, that you probably are limited in the way surgeons approach the liver. So he was not obese, but again, you know, it's not perfect correlation, so you inflict injury to liver even in a non-obese patient. But we only use 3 cycles, which I do believe there is, especially when you use oxaliplatin-based therapy, the longer you treat, the more significantly injured the liver will be. That's why if you ever have a patient in this clearly neoadjuvant setting where you just want to test chemosensitivity, there's no use treating longer to best response. You just want to fulfill the purpose of the treatment, meaning when you see the tumor shrinks, and then take the patient to surgery.
And now, were you thinking of resecting the primary at the same operation?
Yes, and it was actually, this was kind of pre-negotiated with our liver surgeon and colorectal surgeon, and they agreed that they would do this in the same surgery.
So what happened?
So he had wedge resections of the liver. It's actually interesting, we see more wedge resections now from our liver surgeons, not the anatomical resections, segmentectomies or hemipatectomies, probably with the idea of that they spare liver parenchyma for potential future resections. And had surgery, had no problems, no complications. That was about 2 years ago, and actually received about 8 cycles of FOLFOX afterwards, then ran into neuropathy and stopped treatment before we had this complete 12 cycles of therapy perioperatively. So he had 3 cycles before, 8 cycles afterwards.
So he gets that resection and he does well. Then what happens?
So then we followed him with routine scans. And in fall of this year, about a year and a half after his surgery, he had a significant progression, actually reoccurrence of scattered liver metastases, about 8 liver metastases, clean and non-resectable, actually never resectable from the pattern of spread and the fine distribution of these lesions. And by that time, you know, when we've talked before about potential curative approach, now we talked about this is something we cannot really address in terms of cure. Now we're talking about quality of life issues, duration of therapy, duration of life. We then sat down and discussed, so chemotherapy is the right way to go here, and what's the best option for him? So he had FOLFOX chemotherapy until not too long ago, about a year ago, still had some of the residual neuropathy, the reason why he stopped the treatment, didn't get the 12th cycle, and he never had bevacizumab because we didn't treat him with bevacizumab because apparently the tumor responded to FOLFOX alone. And I sat down with him, talked to him about the analysis about higher risk of bevacizumab in the elderly patients, which is, you know, history of ATE-driven plus age. So he was probably at higher risk for an arterial or venous thromboembolic event.
If he asked you, and I don't know, maybe he did, you know, just not to quote a paper or anything, but just tell me, based on what you know, what do you think the risk is of something like that happening to me?
Yeah. You know, in a patient who's 80 years old who has an inherent risk of, let's say, stroke, heart attack.
Excess whatever, risk, really.
X number. I normally tell them, you know, your risk is probably doubled, whatever this X risk is. And this is based on the meta-analysis, which was published several years ago about these pooled data from 5 different trials.
So then he turns around and he says, okay, well, what is my baseline risk then over the next few years, 2, 3, 4 years?
I mean, in all honesty, I don't sit down. There are calculators on the web, actually, where you take into account, you know, co-medication, history, whatever. I don't do that normally.
I would ballpark
his risk probably in the range of spontaneously next 2 years, 5%, and double the risk into 10%. That's what my best guess would be. I could be off.
Of course, that's in a background now of
a cancer.
Probably, what, 90 to 95% chance of dying in the next few years of colon cancer?
I completely agree. Yeah.
So it looks a lot different in that situation than when you're talking about an adjuvant trial or something.
Absolutely correct. And that's why he actually opted for bevacizumab. Then we talked about the chemotherapy component. And then he decided that he wanted to travel. He wanted a regimen that is giving him a lot of freedom, that he wanted to visit his family. I mean, this is end-of-life issues. Everyone deals with it differently. So he wanted to take the time that apparently he had left, which could be 2 years, 1 year, and a half year, 3 years, who knows, but definitely limited and much more limited than he probably realized before, to see family, to travel, to go to Europe. So we talked about a flexible chemotherapy option, and we chose capecitabine plus bevacizumab, which in the end gives him the chance to even sometimes skip a dose of bevacizumab, come in every 6 weeks after treatment. You know, at the end, when you believe that the half-life bevacizumab is 3 weeks and the actual biologic activity is 6 weeks, because right. That's how much time we give patients before we pick patients to surgery. So he started on capecitabine bevacizumab, and he had a significant response to treatment. Actually,
all your patients respond, actually.
Yeah, quite remarkable. Not all patients. Some of these patients
just
actually progress.
The ones
progress.
We present here.
Some patients progress. You know, it's an interesting point. And chemo-naive patients, nowadays, we're so spoiled. If a chemo-naive patient comes in and progresses on our therapies, we sometimes question, is this really colon cancer? We've been so spoiled. I mean, this is very different than 5-FU many years ago.
For sure. How long now has he been on the Bev capecitabine?
He has been on this now for about 4 months. And we had a scan in between, and another scan is due very soon. Tumor marker was, again, elevated in this progression phase. He had liver enzymes that went up. He has so far tolerated the treatment very well. I mean, he is on a age-adjusted dose of capecitabine, something we might want to add. I do believe that capecitabine has a very narrow therapeutic range when it comes to how to dose. And the standard dose that you see in the package insert would be 1,250 milligrams per meter squared BID, which is way too high for American patients. So for younger patients, we probably go for 1,000 milligrams per meter squared BID. In an elderly patient, I normally start with 850 milligrams BID.